complaining about not seeing snow in New York, but turns out I see a lot of snow here. So this is a tag team, Xingang Eugene tag team talk. So I guess Xingang has talked about some of the stuff that we talk about, but he's going into a lot more detail than I planned to. So I'm actually going to talk a little bit more about, and I'm going to just do more proselytizing instead of actually doing a talk. So I gave the title to the organizer saying I want to talk about features, but really I just really want to talk about things, you know, beyond FNL. You know, we have been really talking, you know, if you look at the observers talk or experiment place talk, we have been always been focused on what FNL is. So I'm trying to convince you that, you know, we should go beyond that, and there's some limitation to what we can what we can actually learn from just looking at the simple-minded FNL thing. His work done with Xingang and Richard. So, okay, here's an outline. So at every theorist talk, there should be a justify your existence talk. I mean, you should actually explain to people why you're being paid to do what you do. So I'm gonna justify why I exist. This is something from The Onion, by the way, if you all do not know about that. Then I'm gonna describe in a couple of slides what the general primordial non-Gaussianities I think is. I think Xingang already talked about that, so I'm actually going to skip that. Then we'll talk about FNL local, FNL equal, and the ML contents, why you're not satisfied with this. Then I will talk about tools for computing general primordial non-Gaussianity, which is part of justifying my existence. I mean, I'm here to develop tools to do that. And finally, I will talk a little bit more about, actually, this is Xingang will talk a little bit about that. He talked most about that. So I'm going to just fill up what he actually didn't say about horizon scale and sub-horizon scale non-Gaussianity and why I think they're interesting. So all the mistakes are mine and all the work are Xingang. Mm-hmm. So justify your existence, right? So we are theorists, right? So we have here 2 days worth of talks on how well we can constrain what FNL is now. So CNB data is getting better, and we are on the threshold of detecting or already detected, which depends on that guy over there, who's now furiously writing his talk, whether or not we actually see non-Gaussianity. Sorry, Kendrick. I don't need to convince you that if you see non-Gaussianity, you're gonna get lots of jobs. What we need to do, if you want to actually constrain inflationary models, is to actually compute useful forms on non-Gaussianities. We want, if our data and our analysis tool is so good that we can actually tell what form of FNL is, we need to be able to map it to whatever model we want. So we need to develop a set of numerical and analytical tools. And if you have been here for a couple of days, and we've seen that the experimentalists and observers have been working hard at, you know, using a lot of tools to actually constrain their observations. So are we up to that? Are we ready for that? No, it's not the other way around. So, okay, you've seen this. But what I want to say is that right here, right. So when we talk about FNL local and FNL equal, they are actually talking about skill invariance type non-Gaussianities. Which what I mean is that if you shift the each individual momentum by lambda, this 3-point correlation function, this is really, this is how we define. So there's the momentum conservation kind of like hidden inside. It's shifted by just one over lambda 6. I will come back to that. But now, why FNL local? Well, it's the most simple-minded thing you can do. I mean, this kind of invented by Salopek and Bond, and then Chiro and Davis Burgo expanded on it and actually developed a lot of the mathematics to actually deal with this thing. And in the language that we normally talk about now as theories, FNL local, this looks like this. You know, it's not very illuminating. But it has nice properties that makes it easy to work with, which is why it's so popular. And it's mostly due to the fact that you only have one field, phi of x, that's the fundamental view, and it's Gaussian, so you can do a lot of nice eukaryotic tricks on this. How do you make this type of non-Gaussianity? Heuristically, you can say that it's large-scale evolution of the curvature perturbation. In fact, so large. Then you say, why local? No, it's a large-scale evolution of non-Gaussianity. Why do you call it local? Well, it's local because it's just a point-wise source. That confused me for a long time. One way to actually get this non-Gaussianity is the thing of multi-field uncoupled inflation. So you can, this is the curvature perturbation outside the horizon, and then this is the expansion. And then you can see that this form, delta phi and delta phi squared, just looks kind of like this, phi and phi squared. And then so F and L local measure the derivatives of this expansion of scale factor respect to the two fields. This is just one example. There are many, many examples you can construct using this kind of expansion. So, and single slow, and there's a kind of a comment that say that, well, single field slow row is local. It's not really quite local, but it's local in the squeeze limit. And physically, what's going on is that non-Gaussianity is kind of generated around the horizon crossing. And this is shown by Malacena and Aquivella and people, and it's, I think I missed that by 1 year. So then the other thing is that, well, why F and L equal? And this is introduced by Babbage et al, who is Daniel, sitting right over there, and expanded over in the other paper by Kramnalik et al. And it's defined by setting the normalization of the equilateral triangle to some fixed value, and it looks like this completely unilluminating form. And assuming scale invariance, this, roughly speaking, is orthogonal to local shape, which in a way why it makes it so useful. And you have seen some plots on that. And its symmetry, because it's equilateral, it allows some construction of some simple estimators. And I'm going to make this statement that in this world right now, there live two estimators. One estimator for equal form and one estimator for local form and nothing else. It's a very, very non-pluralistic world. So beyond F and L, right? If we break scale invariance and all hell breaks loose, you know, this is no longer true, then my former office mate used to say, why, Eugene? You know, say, why do you want to do that, right? Well, doesn't scale invariance power spectrum, which we see now, guarantee scale invariant 3-point? So the answer is no. I'm going to show you why it is no. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I exist, right? So morphologically, I mean, CMB data allows us to constrain model inflation. We can't constrain it if we don't know how to predict. So, okay, now I'm going to switch gears now and proselytize a bit and introduce this formalism that I think is incredibly powerful. So you've seen Malacena's beautiful paper, we have used the tools developed by him. And it's really a rehash of what Stringer and Kaldish did, and they call it an informalism. And it is, Malacena introduced this into the analysis of higher point correlation functions. And a lot of this work moving, bringing this formalism into cosmology is done by Jordan and Calzetta, who's sitting right over there. And again, reintroduced into modern cosmological perturbation theory by Weinberg in 2005. So this is, it's a well-developed formalism. Well, I'm not going to talk too much about it, but for the QFD inclined audience in you, it's really just computing QFD on a dynamical background, JIC, to compute correlation functions at fixed time instead of transition amplitudes between different asymptotic states. That doesn't make any sense to people. So here's skipping through all this technology. Here's if you really care just about correlation function and non-Gaussianity, this is all you need to know. So this is your master formula for three-point correlation function. This is the equation that you want to solve. So it's the three-point correlation function. It's equal to integral over wherever you want to start your integration. This is minus infinity, you know, future past infinity, to whatever time you want to stop. So this time, tau is when you take the correlation. As the integral over this commutator of some interaction term, which measure how far you are from just free field theory, and just some 3 points, so the 3 point taken at time t. And I point the arrow here to this Hi, which is constructed out of all these fields, that these are Heisenberg free fields. The importance about why.
Oh, I really don't want to charge me for this drawing paper.
Okay, so why do I emphasize this? Well, because it is free fields. And if you want to solve this equation, you can solve it numerically because it's free fields. It's easy. It's linear. So you can actually plug it into a computer and wait for a finite amount of time and get out the answers. And then what you can do is just plug in your solution in linear equation into this integral and integrate, which is why I think not only this formalism is beautiful in the sense that you understand and control what you're doing, it's also very numerically friendly. There are other ways that you can compute non-Gaussianities. You can also simulate in a lattice if you want to. But this is, you know, this is great. You understand it theoretically, and you can solve it numerically, which is why you think that, I know, at least I think that this is the, a great thing. So here's what I just say. And not only that, I mean, because this is kind of based on QFD, you can import some of your intuition from QFD into the analysis. So I'm a proponent of shut up and integrate. So which what I say is that what I'm trying to say is that, okay, there's no mention of inflation in the formalism that I just talked about. It's on a dynamical background. So you can plug in that inflation. If you're a little bit crazy, you can try to plug into a radiation domination universe. So you can it doesn't matter what the background of the universe is. That formula I just described to you is completely true all the time. In fact, the fact that it's an in, it means that you just need to impose conditions, boundary conditions on one in vacuum. So you need to impose conditions on just the early time, that you choose it to be early time, and so you know what the initial conditions are, and then that's it. You don't have to worry about what's going on in the future. In fact, the correlation function tells you what is the state of the universe at that particular time. And this time t can be whatever you want to be. You can integrate it through horizon crossing or not, through radiation domination or not, horizon reentry, whatever, until it hits our eye. So what you really need to do if you want to do that is to know what's the background. You need to know which interactions, which has all the terms, like all the photon baryons, all the stuff that you see in the universe, plug it in, buy a new very big computer, and integrate. Shut up, integrate. So I know that David Seary gave a beautiful talk yesterday about this, another way of, another philosophy of how to compute correlation functions, is to do use this formalism, integrate until horizon crossing, match this the solutions at horizon crossing to another formalism called the delta n formalism, which in some ways actually easier to manage. And then you kind of have two sets of two for different regimes. Well, my philosophy is just integrate, keep integrate. You know, you can buy more computers. It's a kind of dumb thing to do, but no, you can do it. Why not, right? So, but there's a lot of physics hidden inside this equation. If you look at what the terms of interaction is, you can see that for single field inflation, because all perturbations freeze out, so H has theta dot term inside. Theta dot becomes zero, these terms become zero, so you have no contribution to your correlation function after horizon crossing. So you can see some physics. And not only that, evolution outside the horizon generates non-Gaussianity of local type. And if you just take the k equals zero limit inside interaction term, you get local type non-Gaussianity. So and you don't have to worry. You don't have to worry about what's going on inside your zeta. It could be isocurvature, it could be adiabatic. We don't care. Plug it in, integrate. So also an advertisement for David Sherry's talk. There's different way of doing things. But it says here's how I like to look at it. So okay. So here's all the math. So we have two prong approach. Jing Gang talked a little bit about that. So but I'm just gonna bang it into your head and say, well, we should really approach this problem both analytically and numerically, because as you can see, this integral might be formally easy to write down. It's hard to integrate analytically, especially when you have crazy physics going on in the background. So what we really want, well, what the observers really want, is that we want some f function which is factorizable. And what I mean by factorizable is that fk1, k2, k3 can be written as function of k1, k f1, k1, f2, k2, f3, k3 times some sign of k1 plus k2 plus k3 or some other combination. You can use trigonometric identities you learned in high school to actually expand them, and some 1 over this term. And this doesn't seem like it is factorizable at first sight, but Kendrick and Mathias have shown a beautiful trick that you can actually, this is actually factorizable. And not that, no, you want to write it down, you want to find some way of be able to analyze this. And Jing Gang has shown some of the techniques that we used. And not just that it's good to be able to derive this thing, you get a sense of what's going on behind, what the physics going on. So it's useful to look at it in an analytical way. And also, well, you can do this, right? But when you do all this crazy approximation, you're not really sure what's going on. Well, you're not sure whether or not you're taking the right approximation. So that's where numerical methods comes in. Not only if you hire a very smart postdoc and ask him to write code. And you can actually get exact forms. So you plug in your computer, you get exact forms, and sometimes this exact form might not be factorizable, but you can use it for some other tools. You don't have to worry. You don't have to just be focused on bispectral methods. You can think about Minkowski functional, which you doesn't have to find to be factorizable. So you know, exact forms are useful. And it's also very useful to cross-check with your analytical approximations. Your numerical method will give you the right scalings with your parameters, what the gross features are. So it's when we try to derive these things, I mean, we always go back to the numerical method and say, okay, does our analytical estimation is, you know, compare well to what the numerical results are. So, and it's also an on-principle thing. It's kind of a Steven Weinberg thing. So, you know, we do it because we can, right? So maybe it's not Steven Weinberg, but he's a big hero. So I'm going to cover some of the ground that Xingang has already covered a little bit, so I'm going to go through it very quickly. But here's the formula you want to integrate. But here's the three sentence intuitive understanding of what's going on, right? Why do we get non-Gaussian habits? Inflation is the great smoother. It likes to smooth things out. You give stuff in, the quantum no-hash theorem will tell you that far in the future, it would look very, very smooth. So and you know, and this fact that it likes to smooth things out is encoded in the small Sorow parameters. The epsilon is small, so the interaction couplings are small. In fact, in the pure distilled limit, you're not going to get any non-Gaussian. In fact, you're not going to get any perturbations because it's already smoothed out. But what is generating its non-linearities? It's gravitational coupling collapse. Stuff like to come together because of Einstein, you know, of gravity. And the right interaction couplings, you know, if you write down a potential with 555 term or 55555 term, they like, you know, they like to interact. It can be repulsive, it can be attractive, you don't really care. The point is that when they have interaction, they like to clump or they like to push away from each other, and that generates correlations or anti-correlations. And that's what gets you non-linearity. So this is, if you want to quickly get a sense of whether your model is going to give you large non-Gaussian or not, keep this picture in mind, it's very useful. So anyway, after all this discussion, we want to classify mechanisms into two broad classes. This is completely arbitrary, but we do it because we think that it's a very good way of actually showing that not only we can get non-Gaussianity at the horizon scale, which is what people have been talking about because it's FNN local, we can get sub-horizon scale non-Gaussianity, and this is kind of surprising. I mean, this is a resonance model, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. I was being facetious when I say use top most of it. Anyway, so okay, Xingang has talked about this already, so I'm going to skip this. That's 10 more minutes, and well, I'm not going to skip this because this is the code, right? This is numerical simulation of non-Gaussianity generated by a BAM model done in 3D. This is K3, this is one axis, the other axis. This is what Xingang called A or K1, K2, K3. And we choose this parameter to plot because it's scale, it's dimensionless, so it's a nice scale. And the time, well, our time, refers to the third parameter. It's a 3D cube, so you have to, I only have 2D space. So let's play it again, because it's very cool. So you can see all the ripples, and these ripples are what Xingang was saying, that there's a sine term inside your non-Gaussianity if you have a feature in your potential. So, and we can do this for as large a grid as you want. And that's why code is good, right? So anyway, as you can see, I know you all would know that because of the feature, you're gonna get some large non-Gaussianity, which is observable, and hopefully, you know, we have the numerical form, we have an approximate analytical form. So the goal is to write down an estimator for this form, and it's not trivial because it's sinusoidal, but we're working on it. So okay, so we are going to talk about this, how to do this, blah blah blah. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit more about this horizon scale generation model, the resonance sub-horizon scale generation model, the resonance model, and this is kind of a serendipitous. We were actually writing our second paper when we were writing it, and I said, hey, you can, you know, from looking at the equation hard enough, you can see that you can actually, you have another method, like completely different method of generating non-Gaussianity. So what is it? What is it? If you imagine you have a potential that have ripples like this, and these ripples occur on very, very short time scales, then you can think that eta prime now is also rippling, right? Eta prime is the second derivative of the potential. So you also undergo some sinusoidal behavior. But this term here, this tree, this product of tree mode functions, deep inside the horizon, is just a wave. So it has some sinusoidal behavior. And normally, because this is a constant, when you take this the integral deep inside the horizon, what happens is that all this oscillation cancel. It's not trivial to see it's canceled, but it does. But because now at some period of time, this thing is oscillating, you can imagine a some fixed time when this frequency of this product of tree mode is the same as the frequency of the couplings. So this is when it goes in resonance, hence the name of the model. So, and it can lead to constructive interference, it can lead to destructive interference, or it could just not do anything. But, and then you can kind of expect what the non-Gaussian theory look like, right? Because you have constructive interference, destructive interference, it's gonna look like sinusoidal, and it does. So here's how it works. If you plug this simple model in, and you choose parameter such that the frequency of the oscillation is, you know, it's much higher than the Hubble length, so the frequency is deep inside the horizon. But you choose parameters such that, you know, everything is still nicely subplunkant, so no crazy physics going on. And here's what happened: this little line here is the cumulative non-Gaussian entities. You remember, you're integrating over some from negative infinity to some fixed time, and the non-Gaussian entities collapse as you integrate them. And this thick line here is the mode evolution. It's just one of the modes, so you have to multiply this by 3 to get the higher frequencies. And this little dotted line here, the much more thick dotted line, is the evolution of eta prime. And you can see, you know, if you look hard enough and spend enough time looking at this plot, when the frequency of the mode evolution and the eta prime is the same, you get this bump. And if you evolve this, you know, further back, you see the bump, you go oscillate this way. And you evolve far in the future, you just keep on oscillating. So at some fixed time, you receive some resonance. And since eta prime is some, the frequency of eta prime is some constant, or not roughly constant, but all modes will rate shift. All modes will undergo resonance at least once. In fact, if you have just one frequency, they will go through all resonance once. So all modes will get this boost. So it generates large non-Gaussian entities that are non-decaying. Instead, you know, we can decay in the far future, in the large K modes or the small K modes, you know, get ignacidas. And this is kind of like first example of a model with some frequency scale instead of a length scale. So anyway, and I think this is very cool. So anyway, here's the result. Right, G over K cube is again the parameter that we plotted is dimensionless. And look, it can get 30. This is some simple minor parameter. Some simple parameters scales that we choose so that, you know, we can actually simulate this thing. And look, if G over K cube equals 30. And if you choose some other parameters, you get maybe a small number, maybe you get bigger numbers, but they're big. But since C, which governs how much the amplitude of the oscillation in the potential is so small, it's 10 to the minus 6. The power spectrum is change in the power spectrum is very, very small. Look, this is actually a numerical simulation of the change of power spectrum. You kind of hardly see it. And when you run it through CMB physics, you're not going to see these oscillations. And look, this is scale invariant, right? Well, roughly scale invariant. But here, look, it's going crazy. So, you know. It's arbitrary units. So we can choose K, okay, all right. We can choose K choosing whatever frequency W is would change what the unit is. And I'll show you the exact form and then I'll explain what.
Because I guess I'm worried that frequency is larger average.
Good point, right. It's actually gonna be very, very large. So this is one issue where we can actually find some parameters where the oscillation is not that large. I'll talk about it. The next one. So, but well, the point is, I mean, this is my why, the answer to why Eugene, right? I mean, scale invariant power spectrum doesn't always lead to scale invariant 3-point. In fact, I think it's general. I don't think, because in a sense, 2-point and 3 points are statistically independent. So, okay, here's the analytical estimate. You plug in, you do some field math, you plug in the values, and this is the form of the non-Gaussian RT you get. So this is F, you know, F resonance, and you notice that I've removed F and the NL because I hate NL. And then it look and it looks like 2 over phi L is the parameter of scale and K. So K is, you can see this funny dependence on the frequency. So if you just blindly plug in these numbers, actually K turns out to be very, very large. This number turns out to be very, very large. So in fact, the frequency, you can actually see what the frequency in K space that you measure. This is, you can imagine that L, this is about L to 10 and L to 100. And this will be the frequency of the non-Gaussian entity in the equilateral case. So it's very, 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 very fast, very oscillating very rapidly. We are looking for parameter space where we can tune down the parameters such that the oscillation is less, but we get less non-Gaussian energy. So here, that's the caveat. But on the other hand, we're not trying to sell this model. We are trying to sell the mechanism. We are trying to explain that there's a different mechanism that you can get non-Gaussian energy from, other than just blindly say, well, non-Gaussian energy will be generated at near horizon scale. So okay, I got 5 minutes. Okay, well, that's so. So I think I'm gonna be done very soon. So here's the advertisement for the non code that we wrote. I mean, non is, in fact, this name I just invented like last night. But I think, you know, all cool code must have a name, right? But it's very trademark. Yeah, it's very trademark. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So what can the code do, right? What can the code do? The code can do general, you know, single field canonical kinetic models with arbitrary non-slower parameters. It doesn't have to be slow roll. And arbitrary initial conditions. You can put Bunch-Davis in, you can put non-Bunch-Davis in, you can put all sorts of crazy initial conditions for the background in, and you speed out the non-Gaussian code. You have to cheat it a little bit, but it works. In fact, all the results we have in our paper actually is checked using this code. And if you look at this integral that I say we can do, and say, well, you can do solve the linear equations, and you can plug it in. You know, how hard can it be? I mean, does it justify my existence, right? Well, it turns out to be incredibly hard to do that integral because of the blowing up if you take tau goes to minus infinity. So that it cancels if you do it analytically because you're rotating it into the imaginary plane to pick up the vacuum. But when you try to do it numerically, it's actually very hard. And it took a long time to figure out how to do that. And we have now a very robust regulator. We know how to regulate those infinities away. And you can regulate in a control way to any accuracy you want. You just have to hire a grad student, I guess, to actually do the derivatives that you need to actually get this accuracy. But anyway, you know how to do it. And secret is all in this paper that we just published, and you can write your very own code. If you don't want to use this code, you can actually go and read our paper and figure and see how we did it. So at the moment, you know, we are extending it for general K field models, meaning that, you know, instead of this B of phi, we want P of X of phi. And this is in very, very painful progress. And here's the progress. So I'm gonna be done very soon. I'm going to end with some grandiose philosophical conclusions. This is my 2 cents. In fact, I have more than 2 cents. But anyway, we come to this conference. We have seen lots of talks, and we've seen that the analysis tools and experiments are getting to the region, to the time when we can pin down non-Gaussian entities. You know, like in Corby time, it's FNL plus minus 2000. WMAT phi now comes to, you know, this might change in half an hour's time. Who knows? Does it? And you know, but soon we're gonna get WMAP9 and you have Fung and LSS. This is gonna go down, and you're gonna know not just the value of FNL local, but we're gonna start probing the structure of what FNL looks like. But if you look at a theoretical one, you have hodgepodge of methods. You have rough approximations, or what I call Euler method. You have delta N formalism. You have field theoretic methods. You have numerical methods, and there's too much focus on the local form. Now, if you look at most of the papers, you compute what I look for. It's fair in the sense that it's easy to deal with, and we have bounds on it. But still, you know, we should try to go beyond FNL. Right? I want to advertise the in-functional methods because it is, I think it's actually providing us a unified and numerical-friendly approach. And you get again a lot of understanding of what's going on behind the physics. And I think the greater goal, is the development of some generic codes to compute primordial non-Gaussian energy, some like a non-fast instead of a CNB fast. You know, give us the model, plug it in, what does the FNL look like? So I think that's just so much more work to do. Thank you very much.
So questions for your team? So you haven't tried Mark 9 faster?
No. I'm sending the table. I'm not sure if Canadian would pick up.
Questions?
Okay, so, oh yeah, please.
I just have a comment.
Okay.
By the way, I think you made too much the advantage of NN formalism for this calculation, because this is actually a tree-level calculation. You can do this purely in the canonical formalism without very much trouble. The main advantage of an NN formalism is when you want to try to compute one loop amplitude self-consistently.
Yes, I agree. I'm actually working on some of the stuff on the one-loop calculation, but I didn't talk about it. It's exactly a separate talk. I agree. But
so I'm on tree level, it's not that important that you use in it. You can use anything you like.
Well, example like what? I mean, no, I don't think I agree. I mean, how do you compute tree-level diagrams in a numerically-friendly way? How you can take the phi view?
No, I'm saying that formula, the exact same formula you wrote down.
Mm-hmm.
Can be derived much more simply just by looking at Heisenberg equation. Or
oh, no. Oh, I see what you mean. Right. Yes, that's true. You know, like, for example, I mean, Morrison measured.
Yeah, exactly. From 1960s.
Right? Technically, quantum field theory is more convenient than old fashioned.
Yeah, for these time dependent. Yeah. But the NN formalism, Schoenger Kaldisch, the forward time, yeah, is more important for loop.
Thank you again.